Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Get me up, be the biggest little flirt. Well, I might have.
Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Hey, it's actually starting to cool down just a tiny, tiny bit. I'm so grateful for that. It's Monday. And this is your host, Veronica Linnae. Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone. I am phoning this in from Northern California, and my guest this evening is from Lake Forest, California. She is the author of a brand new book called Happily Even After. That's not Happily Ever After, it's Happily Even After. Her name's Carol Brody Fleet. She's an award-winning author. She came out with a book a few years back called Widows Wear Stilettos. And that sounded kind of exciting. She's actually got a website by that name. Same thing, www.widowswearstilettos.com. I'm over there looking at it right now. You should go over there and check it out as well. She's been all over the place, all kinds of TV shows. She's also the founder and CEO of Widows Wear Stilettos Incorporated. And she's a widely recognized leader and expert in the areas of grief and loss recovery. I found the table of contents to her new book really intriguing. But without further ado, let's welcome Carol Brody Fleet to the Shame Free Zone. Thanks so much, Carol, for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Veronica. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm looking at your book, and I'm loving it. But before we dive in, I've got some pages, you know, marked. I want to ask you questions. But I understand that your expertise in this topic was actually born out of your own tragedy. I guess at a very early age, you yourself were widowed. You were about 40.
That's right. That's right. I was widowed at the age of 40. My husband, Mike, who was a police officer for 28 years, here in Southern California, the other state, and we were, and for your listeners, that's a standing joke between Northern Californians and Southern Californians.
Yeah, we got a little bit of a competition going on.
A little bit of a rivalry going on. But he was a police officer. I had retired from the legal profession and was enjoying a career in the beauty and cosmetics industry. In 1998, our daughter Kendall at the time was 9 years old, and we were living life pretty much like everybody else up until the time that Mike was diagnosed with ALS. That's more commonly known as Lou Gehrig's disease, and he passed away 2 years after that diagnosis, and I was left a widow at the age of 40 with a then 11-year-old daughter and absolutely no idea what to do next.
Wow. And whether no books, no resources, no support groups out there, you'd think, especially California, we'd have a plethora of those.
Well, you know, there were books out there, and they were wonderful books. But the problem with the books that I was finding is that everything seemed to just focus on grief and stay centered on grief and coping with grief and loss and dealing with loss and coping with loss and the different facets of loss. And I pretty much had grief and loss nailed. I knew about that. Did not need to read about that. But how do I get my benefits from the government? Am I even entitled to those? How do I help my daughter when I can't even get out of my pajamas? What about the stupid things that people are saying to me? I mean, I know that most of them don't mean to be stupid, but they are. What about things like dating and love and intimacy and all those things that you're afraid to ask because you're afraid of what people are going to think? Nothing was speaking to me at all about these things and a lot more. And back then, I mean, this was 2000, so the internet was still pretty much a baby in terms of resources and support and turning to places. It mostly consisted of, at that point, of chat rooms. And I wasn't looking for a date. And I didn't want to just spend the rest of my life talking about my late husband, and I'm just going to sit around until it's my turn to go. That, to me, was not an option. So it was really the lack of resources that were speaking about things that needed to be talked about that kind of facilitated Widows Wear Stilettos in the beginning of all that.
Yeah, you have been quoted as saying the following, and I think this is, it's just beautiful, really, is that you can honor your past, you can treasure your past, you can love your past, but you do not have to live in your past. And I wonder, Carol, do you think a lot of the popular support and resources on the topic of being a widow or a widower tends to kind of, I don't know, enshrine the former relationship and really make it difficult for you to move on?
Many of them do. Many of them do. A lot of people do elevate their late spouses to sainthood status. And I will be the first to say that Mike Fleet was a great man. He left a legacy of love and friendship and a body of work that is, you know, is very hard to rival. That said, Mike Fleet also left his underwear on the floor. Mike Fleet also needed the window open in January. Mike Fleet was not a perfect human being. And too many people forget that their late spouse was human. And we get that sainthood thing and the enshrining thing. And it, that can prevent you from moving forward. And also, and this is a huge problem, is a lot of people see moving forward as dishonoring the memory of their late beloved and disrespecting the memory of their late beloved. And that's why it's so important to realize that you can combine the past with the present and the future. It's absolutely possible, but you have to be in that right frame of mind to do that.
Well, you even go so far as to help people understand how they can process losing a spouse in a marriage or a relationship that might have been less than ideal. Like maybe it was even seriously deteriorating and they were in the midst of a divorce.
That's right.
Seems like a tall order. How do you help people do that? I mean, it would seem like there was just the guilt would be crushing.
There's such a dichotomy when you, well, first of all, let's back up a second. You know, when people see a widow, meet a widow, they walk amongst the widow community, everybody assumes that all the marriages were, quote, perfect, that everybody was happy, and obviously there's a lot of those stories out there. But you would be shocked, I know I was, at the number of letters that I get where marriages were absolutely deteriorating, mid-divorce, or there was extra marital affairs going on, or there was just all kinds of stories where the marriage wasn't ideal. And the dichotomy comes when the spouse passes away, and the person who's left behind is thinking, why am I grieving? Why do I feel so sad? I didn't want to be married to this person, and I don't know what to do with this. So there's a lot of confusion. Yes, there's guilt, absolutely. But there's also a great deal of confusion, and it's so important to give the surviving spouse permission, if you will, to grieve that loss. It's absolutely normal, and it's natural, and there's nothing to be confused about, but that is one of the permeating emotions in a situation like that.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you are in the shame-free zone, and I think this is an area where people feel ashamed sometimes, is that maybe there'd actually be a part of them that would be glad that they can now move on with their life. And let's say even that the relationship was excellent, but they have transitioned into being the caregiver of their dying partner. Maybe it's a protracted illness.
Right.
And there can actually be some sensations of, thank God I can move on, and wouldn't that evoke a lot of shame and guilt?
Then, yes, it absolutely does, and I was one of those people. Now, it's important to distinguish here the difference between relief and wishing. And people confuse the two. When somebody dies after a long illness, and, you know, speaking as a caregiver of an ALS patient, that's got to be one of the most hideously evil illnesses on the planet. The way that it manifests, the way that it robs and entraps and entombs a patient, the fact that there is no treatment, there is no cure, there is no remission. It is a heinous, awful, evil illness. Nobody deserves that fate. There is a measure of relief that the suffering has come to an end. The suffering certainly that the patient goes through, but the suffering that the loved ones go through as well, physical, mental, emotional, that's relief. That is not to be confused with wishing somebody would die. And people tend to mix all that up in once. If I'm feeling relieved that the suffering has come to an end, it must mean I wished he were dead. Obviously, that's not true. But too many people confuse those two emotions, and it's important to differentiate them.
Yeah, and I get that distinction. I think you've explained that very well. Actually, I'm pretty sure our listeners probably were able to make that distinction too. So that just because you may be glad the suffering is over does not mean you were wishing that the suffering and the resultant death would have ever occurred.
Exactly. But it's normal to, you know, to feel a certain amount of peace that the person that you love so much is no longer in pain and struggling to breathe. They can't eat. They can't speak and make themselves understood. Who wouldn't want that suffering to come to an end? But it doesn't mean that you wish they were, you know, that they were gone.
Well, and in your situation, it was like that. And certainly, I think those are situations that most people can wrap their minds around pretty readily. But what about, let's say you are in the middle of a divorce, and maybe it's a nasty divorce, and then a spouse dies for whatever reason. Let's say it comes without warning. Let's not say it's like a protracted illness, maybe a car accident or something. But you're not, okay, so in that scenario, if you're not divorced yet, you're in the middle of the divorce, but you're not divorced yet, all of the property is going to revert back to you. And unless, of course, there were other arrangements in the will for it to be dispersed elsewhere. But for the most part, it's going to go to the surviving spouse. And it would seem that if you're already in the middle of a nasty divorce, then the person dies, this would be a pretty hard thing to wrap your mind around, because your stance would already be kind of on the attack, and then all of a sudden, they're gone. So how would somebody deal with that in a way that was healthy and balanced?
Well, that does, anytime there's a sudden loss like that, it does shake you. I mean, your whole paradigm just shifted within a matter of seconds. When it comes to the practicalities of being mid-divorce and then there's a death, that really, it's so subjective depending on where you live. Every state is different when it comes to the laws governing divorce. Sometimes it is automatically reverting back to the surviving spouse, and sometimes it's not so automatic. And if there are other family members in the mix, that could confuse things. It's always important to consult legal counsel. Don't just assume that you know it all. And I mean, I've got a legal education. I was in the legal profession for 15 years. But I still would never deign to assume that I knew everything and not consult legal counsel, especially with something like that. The emotional ramifications, again, here's somebody that you were leaving, or maybe they were leaving you. Maybe you weren't the one making the choice. Maybe you're just caught up in all this acrimony and now they're gone. It's very normal to go into these shoulda, woulda, couldas, you know, how things could have been different, how they should have been, how they might have been, how you wish they were. You cannot unring a bell. You cannot put toothpaste back in the tube. You cannot fix what has already happened. All you can do is start taking the steps to move forward from that place, recognizing your right to mourn the end of a life, the end of the promise of a future, which you're probably already mourning if you are mid-divorce. It's okay to grieve. Don't let anybody take that right away from you.
So, you know, you've got kind of a reputation for going into topics here that nobody else wants to take on. And one of them, you even explore the unthinkable when your husband's mistress calls to say he died.
Right.
That's Where did right. you even get the idea for that? Are you going to tell me that happened to somebody you know?
Well, it's important to know that the book is written in question and answer format, as you've noticed. Those questions come from actual letters written by real widows to Widows for Stilettos throughout the last 6 years. These questions were not made up. They were not, you know, I'm not sitting here in my office going, let's you know, throw out some scenarios. These actually came from real letters. Obviously, the excerpts are redacted to protect privacy.
Sure.
But obviously, if the letters are being written, and letters is plural, that means these things are going on out there. And again, like we said at the top of the show, not talking about it doesn't mean that the situation doesn't exist. And when you have a situation where somebody got the call from a mistress, or you've got a mistress fighting for part of the estate, and they think that they're the only ones writing a letter like this, and I've got many of them, all kinds of scenarios. We can't print every letter that comes through. But these are actual people who have dealt and are dealing with these situations. And the reason why it was so important to include these situations in the book is so that others who pick up this book, who might either have experienced the situation or know someone who's experienced the situation, will understand that they're not alone and they don't have anything to be ashamed or embarrassed about. Very, very important.
So that's your central message, is that you don't have to be ashamed. It's great.
That's right. That's right. Because as girls, that's what we do. As women, that's what we do. It's us. It's our fault. We're embarrassed because he was messing around.
Right.
That's not okay. He's the one that messed up here. So let's not be embarrassed and let's not be ashamed, but let's by all means answer the question and talk about the situation and put you on a path of healing.
And what would be a healing path if the mistress wanted to come to the funeral?
Wow. when you're newly widowed, certainly, you are at your most vulnerable. You have no energy for anything, and you have absolutely no fight. And this is where it's so important to find your voice and to surround yourself with people who will prop you up and support you. And if the mistress does not realize that it's not her place, she's not the widow, she should not really have been a part of the paradigm, and she decides to show up, this is just purely opinion, you put other people on notice, and you politely but firmly have that person escorted away. If they want to come and mourn on their own, they can do that after the funeral, but they do not have any place at a funeral. Now, there is a question in the book about a gal whose husband passed away, and he'd been previously married, and was it okay to have his ex-wife there? I thought that was very generous on the part of the widow, and I told her so, and said if there's not going to be any acrimony, if everybody can be at least civil, I think it's a lovely gesture to include an ex-spouse at a funeral, because they did have a life together, and you're acknowledging that. There's nothing wrong with that. But a mistress needs to recognize her place, and her place, unfortunately, for better or worse, is not at the funeral. That's what you buy into when you choose to be the mistress.
Interesting perspective, Carol. Thank you. I have a question for you. You tell your clients, don't just go through it, grow through it.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you mean by that? How could possibly a death be a situation that one could grow through? What kind of growth would one anticipate?
Well, it's not anything that any of us sign up to do, certainly, but there are lessons to be learned. I could have entitled both books Don't Let This Happen to You, Parts 1 and 2, but I did not think they were catchy titles. I think that there's so many learning lessons on the healing journey that you need to pay attention to. The first most important thing is to recognize that you are not the same person that you were when you got married. You cannot go through the widowhood experience and come out the other side the same. There are a lot of things about pre-widow Carol that I miss. Pre-widow Carol was a lot lighter, and I don't mean literally, I mean figuratively. Just a little more.
Emotionally, right?
Yeah. I was a little more frivolous. Pre-widow Carol was not anxious. I had a little bit more patience. Post-widow Carol is not as much fun all the time. Post-widow Carol is really not patient. But you know what else? Post-widow Carol is strong and doesn't worry about so much what other people think as pre-widow Carol used to. And there was an incredible growth and a new and deeper appreciation for life and what I have and what truly is precious and what really isn't worth worrying about. You learn what to fight over, whether you're fighting with your children or you're fighting with a significant other. You learn what's important and what isn't. And that is part of the growth, I think, that comes with the healing journey. And that goes for any healing journey. It's not just widowhood.
Right. I think it's really important to treat any life transition as an opportunity to grow and to learn. But as one's learning to embrace the new person that they're going to become, mm-hmm. Apparently there is some difficulty. I mean, all your friends are probably couples, so it might kind of seem at your age, especially depending on what age you are, that the world is made up of couples and all this thing, and you're a single person again. How would one go through that?
Feeling like the cruise director on Noah's Ark. That's how I described it in the first book. And I remember feeling that way because what I did not realize is that after Mike died, that there was going to be a friendship attrition and that many of the friends that were a part of our regular lives and our social life and just kind of fell by the wayside. These abandonment issues, if you will, are very, very common. Again, it's taken a lot of years, but I have, and a lot of letters, to find out that so much of this, Veronica, seems to be the rule rather than the exception.
Right.
Instead of wasting time being hurt and devastated by people who were choosing to abandon me and my daughter, I instead focused on the people who chose to stay around. And it's like being the conductor on a train. Don't worry about who's getting off. Worry about who's getting on, strapping in, and staying for the ride. And these are the people that I focus on. And they're around to this day. That's what you worry about. It's not uncommon for people to fall away, whether it's because they're uncomfortable with your widowhood, whether it's because that they feel like you are going to be a man-eater that's going to chase after their spouse. And that happens a lot. Whatever the reason, they've made their choice, you can make yours. Focus on who's still with you and focus on the wonderful people that you've yet to meet. Because even though, again, nobody signs up for widowhood, but the friendships that I have now as a result of working in the widowed community and of taking the direction that I've taken with my life, these are friends that I will have for the rest of my life. And they are the most precious, wonderful friendships.
Hmm. Yeah. You actually talk about something called the 5-date rule. So now we're kind of fast forwarding here to fine, I'm not a couple anymore, and all my friends are couples, and I'm ready to start some new friends here. So I'm going to start dating, and now there's a 5-date rule. What does that mean?
Well, you know what it means, but we'll share it with the listeners. I get so many letters, and I love when I get letters from widows and widowers that say, I'm ready to date again. What are the rules? Have they changed? What's going on in the millennium? What are the dating rules? Well, those questions take me back to a wonderful period of time where my best friend Sharla and I, we were single and dating, and we would, when one of us would go out with somebody new, the other one would caution, don't forget the five-date rule. And the five-date rule is quite simply, you got to wait at least 5 dates before you choose to become intimate. And that was the rule that we always teased each other about back then. Somebody, one of the questions in the book was, "What if, I've heard about the five-date rule, but what if I'm not ready after 5 dates?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Well, then you're not ready. Yeah, if you're not ready after 5 dates or 10 dates or the 30th date, then you're not ready. There are no rules. Actually, there is one rule that I am, you know, dead set about, and that is the first date rule. I do have the first date rule, and that for me is no falling into bed with somebody after the first date, and I don't care if he's Prince Charming with flags flying and lords leaping and all that neat stuff. I don't care. The only thing you should be falling into bed with after the first date is Cosmopolitan magazine and, you know, a glass of wine or a cup of hot chocolate and Nick at Night. I don't care. But after the first date, the answer is no, at least if you want to hear from him again.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I would hope so, although I certainly wouldn't shame anybody who did go to bed with somebody on the first date. I just don't think it's a prescription for it being a...
Oh, I would never shame anybody because, you know, let's be honest, we've all breached the first date rule. We've done it. I will say it on national radio.
I was much younger. She has breached the first date rule.
No, you don't shame anybody. But when people in a very vulnerable place, and even when you are ready to date again, that's a different kind of vulnerability because you are stepping out in faith. You're stepping out in hope. You're stepping out in one whale of a lot of courage. So you really don't want to, you want to mitigate any mistakes that you possibly can. And we know that this is a mistake. So it's not a question of shame. It's a question of let's be smart. Let's do this the right way. And the right way is maybe not the first date. You know, maybe you should know someone's last name.
Oh, for God's sake. And if you haven't been dating for a long time, it's going to be a shock to the system. So go slow.
Absolutely.
Really. Yeah. Yeah, and you've already had enough shocks to the system. So how can, you know, there's other facets of life that come into play here, like holidays. You know, we talk about the body here. A lot of times the body will have memories of certain holidays, the anniversary. You might just have a physical memory of that, and it will come up. Also, the death of your spouse might be kind of buried in your body, and so, I mean, sometimes holidays can be problematic, too, because it, you know, arouses memories of, oh, well, we used to do this, we used to do that. So how can people put a positive spin on that?
The most important thing is to tune into how you're feeling at that moment in time. And don't let other people tell you what you should be doing, what you shouldn't be doing, what they're going to make you feel guilty about if you aren't doing or are doing. This is about you. We lost Mike 6 days before Christmas and right in the middle of Hanukkah, so we are really getting holidayed to death when he passed away. And,
wow.
You know, even to this day, our daughter, who is now 23 years old, there is still a solemnity. There is a quietness about her as that date approaches. She's fine after she gets past that date, but even now, she gets a little quiet, a little introspective, but she tunes into how she's feeling, and she goes with that. The first couple of years, we did stay quiet. We learned the difference between observing the holidays and celebrating the holidays.
Right.
And we just kind of kept to, you know, to ourselves. But as time went on, we started doing different things. I think it was 5 years after Mike died, my daughter, my mother, and I went to Las Vegas for the anniversary of his passing and before Christmas week. We had a blast. And that's exactly what Mike would have had us do. Go to Vegas, win some money, have a cocktail, and drink to his memory. To his mind, I know, it was so much better than sitting around morose saying, well, here's another year, and he's not here again. So for holidays, it's about tuning into you. It's, you know, is there a favorite dish or drink that he loved? If it makes you feel great, go ahead and feature that. We still decorate a tree with Mike's favorite Christmas ornaments. And actually, now that our daughter's on her own, she has those ornaments in her own home. These are all great sources of comfort. But if you feel like mixing it up, taking a cruise, going to a beach if you live in a snowy climate, going to the snow if you live here in California, you do what you want to do. And if you feel like mixing it up, not being full around a house full of people or crowds or what have you, do that. It's okay. And every year will take on a different complexion, and you go with what that year is presenting to your heart.
Really, really sound advice. What about, you have some interesting terminology in your book. One of the things you talk about is a technical widow and a not technical widow. And this is actually in the very beginning of the book where you're talking about who am I? So I'm assuming you mean technical widow. It means that you actually were still married.
Well, a technical widow means that you were married. That when your spouse passed away, you were married, and there's a piece of paper, and you walked down the aisle, and you were married. And that's a technical widow. Somebody who is not technically widowed is what we call a widow of the heart. And that is a fiancé, a boyfriend or a girlfriend. Our friends in the LGBT community who are so sorely overlooked because of archaic laws that prohibit them from getting married in all but 7 states. These are people who have spousal-type relationships, but unfortunately are not being treated with the same respect that they deserve. And at Widows Wear Stilettos, we welcome anyone and everyone who has lost a spouse, regardless of age or gender or technical marital status or sexual orientation or circumstances surrounding spousal loss. We welcome anybody who has lost the person that they were meant to spend the rest of their life with. So the not-so-technical widow, as it's phrased in the book, simply refers to somebody who did not get to walk down the aisle and doesn't have a piece of paper. But if love is love, then loss is loss. The heart doesn't know about pieces of paper and, you know, file this and do with that and laws and all that.
Oh, yeah.
The heart doesn't know that. All the heart knows is the loss, and that's what we recognize and respect.
Well, and speaking of that, what whatever side of this you're on, whether you got the little piece of paper or you don't, once you've lost your partner, what is the question, who am I, and how does one answer that?
When you've been functioning as one half of Mr. and Mrs. the two of you, you really are, you're lost. Because you forget that you were actually, you know, somebody on your own before you got married. And it really doesn't matter how little or how long you were married. So there's that process. The other part of who am I certainly comes into play if you have dealt with a long-term illness or infirmity. Because that illness or infirmity governs your life. It decides whether or not you can leave the house. It decides whether or not you can have a cheeseburger on Sunday with your child. It decides everything. Now that part is gone too. So the days seem about 49 hours long. You don't know what to do with all these hours. You literally don't know who you are, and there you don't have a sense of direction. You don't know what to do next. You don't know what to do first. It seems like everything needs to be done at once, and you don't know where to start. So if you don't know where to start, you don't start at all. And that's the whole who am I process. And on top of everything, you're numb. You are exhausted. You're physically run down. You are emotionally spent. And it is just, it's a fog. It's an absolute fog. And that's the who am I of widowhood.
So, yeah. Well, that's where you start. But where should one be going to? Do you need to get a sense of yourself as an individual again?
That's the most important thing, is to begin the discovery of you. That's why I caution people about when everybody talks about the dating thing, and everybody wants to know when it's appropriate to start dating. Again, that's the permission factor. I caution against people starting to date too soon, but not for the reasons that everyone will think. You know, after the funeral, and that you're single, and there's nothing inappropriate about dating again. But if you don't know who you are so inclined to invite the wrong people into your life for the wrong reasons. And the wrong reason is you're plugging up a hole, you're filling a void. Rather than dealing with the pain in healthy, productive ways, you are plugging up the hole in the living room, at the dining room table, in the bed next to you. It is really painful to face that hole, but face it, you must. And that's why you don't want to re-involve too soon, because you're still in that discovery process. And if there's children involved, you need to help facilitate their recovery as well. Not to the exclusion of your own, but you have to help them recover and find their footing. And, you know, help them ease into a world without daddy, if you will.
You had children at the time who were, they were not even in junior high yet. Isn't that true? They had a daughter?
Yeah, that's true. In fact, she was just shy of entering junior high school when her daddy passed away.
So how did you help her through that? Did you send her to any support groups? Or?
Well, she had been in counseling. Actually, we'd all been in counseling with our rabbi, more for a practical reasons than spiritual. We just all really needed a roadmap as to how to navigate this horrendous situation that we were in. But, you know, and keeping in mind that I absolutely made mistakes along the way, I absolutely own that. What I tried to do, and what I do to this day, is create the environment where she knew then, and she knows now, that if she wants to be angry, sad, really, really sad, quiet, laugh uncontrollably, anything that she wants to discuss concerning the loss of her dad, she is welcome to discuss. So many parents will say, either to themselves, to their kids, or to both, we're done now. Grief time's over. We're not talking about it anymore. I don't know how you can tell somebody else how to feel, but it's happening. And when you do that, and you are compelling a child to stuff their feelings down, put them away, they're going to come back. They're going to come back. That child's going to seek anesthesia because they're in pain. And anesthesia can come in a lot of forms: alcohol, drugs, compulsive sexual behavior, self-mutilation, compulsive gambling. There's all kinds of destructive ways to deal with the pain of loss. There is a continuum of dialogue going on, if there is a freedom, an understood implicit freedom to feel however you want to feel at that moment in time, chances are excellent that you won't have to deal with the destructive forces that can come in.
Mm.
And we were fortunate in that Kendall did choose the road less traveled rather than the path of least resistance. That does not mean that there weren't bumps along the way. It did not mean that she did not hit periods of overwhelming sadness and depression.
And
it doesn't mean that even now, when she's had her milestone moments, you know, her senior prom, when she learned how to drive, which I was stuck teaching her how to do, and I will never forgive her dad for that one. When she leaving me with that. When she won her first national cheerleading championship, and he wasn't there to see it. These are things that will always be sad that her dad's not here. But there's also so much happiness going on, and there's a new life that we have now that, once again, it's the integration of the past into the present and future, and she's done that, and we've done that.
A beautiful journey. It really is. Mm. What about, it's Carol, since we're getting a little bit personal here, have you moved on and found a new love?
I have, indeed. In 2007, I did find my Prince Charming, or rather, he found me. And we were married in 2009. He is a wonderful, beautiful man inside and out, and he even comes with a British accent.
And, wow.
Which girls everywhere love. And he is the executive vice president of Widows Wear Stilettos now. He, I've said this so many times, it's wonderful when a spouse looks at you and says, I support you in what you do. But for a spouse to, come in and look at what it is I do, and let's face it, it's, I deal with death every day, and look at it and say, not only do I support what you do, I admire what you do, and I can help you take it to new levels. And he's done just that.
And what is it that you do then? You travel around doing keynotes, or do you also teach workshops?
The answer is yes. About the only thing I don't do is change motor oil. I do a lot of speaking on a number of different subjects. It's not just death. I did not want to be the death lady. So it is many different things. In fact, one of the more popular workshops that I teach is about the world of dating after loss, divorce, or breakup. And I also teach a workshop about intimacy, which is absolutely hilarious, really. But at the heart of all of it is a great deal of learning about you and about what's going on out there and about how you can find love again, too, because we're all entitled to that.
Sure. And that's actually something, that you are, strangely enough, although you're dealing with death, I would think that you've learned a lot about just basic skill sets that one needs, even if you're just getting a divorce. I would think you would actually know a lot about that.
Absolutely.
In your book, you talk about the married widow.
Mm-hmm.
Technically, I'm not yet a widow, but due to a lengthy terminal illness situation, I'm in preparation for life after loss, which is fully grieving, if for no other reason than the loss of the life we once knew. I'm caught in the middle, unable to truly grieve, and yet I'm also unable to go forward with my life. This is one of the people that you talk about in your books on page 81. What do you mean by a married widow?
A married widow is somebody who is really caught betwixt and between. They are dealing with a very, very long-term illness or infirmity situation where their spouse is no longer able to be a spouse. They are a lot of times living in a nursing home because of either mental or physical infirmity. They are completely dependent on others to care for them. So you are technically married, and if you want to continue to advocate for them, you need to stay married. That's important. They need somebody to speak on their behalf. But you are still alive. You are still wanting to go out and experience life and live and do and be. And how do you do that? And
right.
So you have lost the spouse. For all intents and purposes, you evolve from husband and wife, or spouse and spouse, to patient and nurse, or patient and co-caregiver if they are living in a home or in a hospice or some kind of facility. So you're really you're in limbo, and limbo is one of the worst places in the world to be because it's uncertain. And it's shaky, and it's nothing that you can count on from day to day. At least, if somebody has passed away, it's horrible and it's awful and it hurts like all get out.
Mm.
But you can start a healing process. You're always waiting for the other shoe to drop in the married widow situation. And the important thing to do here is to encourage that person to live their lives as much as they possibly can. If they are able to take a trip or have a meal or go to a spa or do whatever it is that will bring them some peace or respite even, that it's okay to go ahead and do that without feeling guilty or neglectful.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, you really did cover a lot of the bases here. Can you tell us a little bit about your organization? Because it seems like you're actually involved in quite a few things, not just giving keynotes, but I'm just maybe, you know, help our listeners know a little bit more about Widows Wear Stilettos. And frankly, I'd love to ask you, why do widows wear stilettos? why did you pick that? That seems to have kind of a sexy little twist to it there.
Well, you know what? I know because of the word stiletto it does, but what it's really meant to do is convey hope and optimism and an attitude that there is life. And also to put a face on widowhood that really has never existed before, and it needs to. The title actually came from a moment at Mike's funeral, although at the time I had no clue that it was going to be a book title. He had a very, very large funeral. Almost 1,000 people were there. And it was a traditional police officer funeral. It was very grand and very beautiful. Now, in the 2 years that we fought his illness, the word widow never occurred to me because you're concerned with survival, not with widowhood. Mm. So as the honor guard in full dress uniform is preparing the flag, who do they always present the American flag to? The widow. And that is the first time that the word widow entered my head. And the very next thought was, I can't be a widow. I wear 5-inch heels. I drink lemon drop martinis. I yell at the Dallas Cowboys on television. I know all the words to the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Widows aren't me. Widows got to be married for 50 years. They have grandchildren. They talk about the Depression. The good old days to me are the 70s. You know? And that was actually the genesis of Widows Wear Stilettos. It was my way of saying we're here too and we won't be ignored anymore.
So basically, this is born out of your own experience. You just felt like, well, I don't fit the stereotype.
Exactly, and it's a stereotype that I have been working like crazy to bust for the last 6 years, and I will keep right on doing that.
Well, and how are you doing that, actually?
I wear stilettos a lot.
I'm over here on your website. I see all the little sexy outfits you wear.
No,
it looks like you and a lot of your cohorts are wearing sexy outfits.
Well, what it's about is continuing to talk, continuing the dialogue, letting the widow community know it's okay to be a widow. We're going to help you through this. It doesn't matter how old you are, because age really is just a number. We have 17-year-old widows, and we have widows up until their late 80s. And it is about breaking down the stereotypes and acknowledging that widowhood can strike anyone at any age, at any time, through any set of circumstances.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, you're going to start reaching out to the widows of service people.
Well, we've been doing that for a number of years, but obviously, as the wars have continued on, that demographic has grown dramatically. So
okay.
we are proud to be of service to our military widowed, because we enjoy giving them other perspectives that are outside the military, and they appreciate meeting widows from other areas that are not just the military. And we do liaison with military widowed support groups as well. So that's very important. But to be as all-inclusive as possible and to show that the face of widowhood is multifaceted, it's not the woman who is in her 80s and talking to her cats. Now, I do talk to my cats, but aside from that, it's not what everybody thinks, and that is what we work very hard to demonstrate.
Well, yes. But you're also reaching out to people regardless of gender. So that's interesting. I mean, mostly the supporters of widows wear stilettos. We are talking about females here, but you do also reach out to widowers and men.
Absolutely.
Who have lost spouses.
Absolutely. Yeah. We have several hundred widowers in our membership, because even though we're called Widows Wear Stilettos, certainly the education that we provide in the books and through the website and so forth applies to everybody. Everybody has financial and legal transitions to make. Everybody has emotional ramifications that they're dealing with. So obviously, you know, anybody that needs that education can come to us and find that education. I feel very strongly about the LGBT community, because if nobody's talking about widowhood, then nobody is talking about the loss that goes on in that community. And the thought of somebody suffering alone or in silence makes me crazy. And that's why we are delighted to welcome, again, several hundred members of the LGBT community who couldn't find anything that spoke to them until Widows Wear Stilettos.
Yeah, actually, I'm looking at, you've got a whole section here called Finances, Legality, and Working Your Way Through.
That's right.
Where you talk about money, the family tree, returning to work, and also just kind of triaging one's financial life. So, you know, what can wait and what cannot wait? What do you need to take care of right away? Carol, I think one of the parts of your message that really appeals to me is that you talk about service, the gift of giving to others. And I often, when I'm working with my clients, they'll say, well, I'm bored or I'm depressed. And I go, well, have you thought about helping someone? And I'm just wondering, like, what kind of service is it that you advocate for your clients to get involved in?
I advocate anything that helps to get you outside of your own dynamic for just a little while, because when you do that, you automatically feel better. We automatically feel better when we're in service to others. For me, it's the widowed community, because there was no direction for me. And if I can help somebody maybe skip over a few of the bumps and obstacles that I ran into 11 and a half years ago, then that's a wonderful thing. But if there's something else out there that speaks to you where you can be in service to somebody who needs something, anything, whether it is food or shelter or clothing, or you want to participate in a charity 10K run walk, which are a lot of fun. I've done that. Find something, a cause that you can be passionate about, that you can help somebody else. You can help lift somebody else up. Because when you do, it doesn't mean your own problems go away, and it certainly doesn't mean that your own problems aren't important. But when you focus on grief and sorrow, it's going to keep you in a place of grief and sorrow. When you begin to focus on service, and when you begin to focus on that which is outside of your immediate dynamic, you will feel better because you made a difference.
Yeah, it's interesting. So sometimes what I tell my clients is, I go, well, you should get into service. They go, well, I don't like people. And I go, well, then how about animals? I don't like animals. They go, how about trees?
Well, if you don't like people and you don't like animals, I'm going to have a hard time helping you. I can't give you an attitude of service. I can't give you an attitude of gratitude. That has to come from within. But when people ask me, and they do, how did you do it? How did you get through? How did you, you know, turn out whole and healthy and happy? You know, it wasn't because I was blessed enough to fall in love with the love of my life again. It wasn't because I woke up one day and all of a sudden there was a publishing contract sitting there, because it did not happen like that. It was because I wanted to focus on something other than grief and sorrow. You gravitate toward what you focus on. And once you choose to heal, once you make the choice to get proactive, get educated, and get busy, everything starts to fall into place. All the healing starts to come in. It doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen quickly, but it does happen.
Well, Carol, you are very definitely a proactive person, and you're putting a lot of positive energy out into the world, and I thank you for that, and thank you for joining me in the Shame-Free Zone. Once again, I want to tell our listeners, this has been Carol Brody Fleet, and we've been talking to her about her brand-new book. It's called Happily Even After, A Guide to Getting Through and Beyond the Grief of Widowhood, and you can get a copy of that just by visiting her website, which is www.widowswearstilettos.com. And next week, I'm going to be interviewing author Rachel Adair. We're going to be talking about All Acts of Love and Pleasure Are Her Rituals, which is actually a book of fiction, which I think you'll find quite interesting. Once again, Carol, thank you so much for joining me in the Shame-Free Zoning. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. Good night.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me. Sering kesepian.